might see this quote behind me on the wall, but yield unto who will their separation. My object in living is to unite.
So welcome to Brave, Bold, Brilliant. I'm here today with Michael Juergens, who is not only an absolute self-professed wine geek, but he's also the Dragon Slayer, we've just found out from your surname. Hi, Michael. Nice to see you.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
Well, it's great that we managed to make this work because you're in the US. I'm actually in Indonesia. So we've got a 13-hour time difference between us. But, you know, we are global natives traveling the world, making things happen. So I'm glad we managed to make it work.
Yeah, this is great. Glad to be here.
Oh, excellent. Now, you have a fascinating kind of, I suppose, two sides to your professional life, shall we say. So you have spent nearly 30 years in management consultancy for one of the very, very large organizations, which I will not mention the exact name of, but you have also got your absolute passion with your business, which is the Bhutan Wine Company. What a combination, Michael. How do you straddle those two worlds?
Well, I think the good news is that where I've been focusing my management consulting career in the last few years is by providing advice to large wineries around the world. And so, you know, having my own winery and also providing services to wineries, you know, you're sort of immersed in that space and that's where you spend a lot of your time. But it's not how I grew up. I mean, I grew up doing technology consulting. You know, I was a little tech guy. And so being able to figure out how to weave my passion for wine into my professional day job, you know, took 25 years, but I figured it out.
Fantastic. Well, they do say, you know, if you love what you do and you can merge your passion with your profession, then that's the absolute sweet spot, right? So you've clearly nailed it.
I you might see this quote behind me on the wall, but yield unto who will their separation. My object in living is to unite. My avocation and my vocation is my two eyes make one inside. I have it on my goddamn wall in my office. How do you bring your avocation and your vocation together? That's actually a quote from a Robert Frost poem. But I love the intent behind it. And so, yeah, I've got it right there every day to remind me.
Fantastic. I love that. So where did the passion for wine start then, Michael? Were you a young wine drinker?
You know, I was a punk rock skateboard kid in Southern California. You know, we did not drink wine. Wine was for sissies. You know, we drank tequila and beer and, you know, whatever else. Long Island iced teas. You know, wine was just not something we did. My parents didn't drink wine. My family didn't drink wine. No one was really into it. And my dad had gone to Italy on a business trip and he had made friends with like the local tavern keeper. He was staying in some small town. And when he left, the tavern keeper gave him like a bottle of wine to take home. It was a 1975 Gattinara. I remember it specifically. And he took it home and he was like, hey, Mike, do you want to drink this wine with me? And I said, absolutely not. Wines are sissies. And he's like, ah, come on, we'll smoke cigars. And my mom, I remember this. I could see it like a movie. My mom in the kitchen, she goes, if you're going to drink cigar or if you're going to smoke cigars, go in the garage. And so we went out in the garage and the garage was full of junk. We like cleared a little space away in front of the washing machine, which was on and it was going to chunk, to chunk, to chunk, to chunk, to chunk. And we trying to figure out how to open this bottle because we'd never opened a bottle of wine before with a corkscrew or peeling the plastic off of it. And we figure out how to get it open. We poured into red Solo cups. And I remember sticking my nose in it and taking that first sip and just like having this epiphany, like, holy shit. Oh my God. Like I didn't understand it, but I understood why people cared about it. And that sort of put me on the path and I sort of fumbled my way around for 10 years or so. And then I got really, really serious about learning and started getting a bunch of industry certifications and reading every book that I could read. But I have a theory on this actually. And the theory is that neurologically, we are all as people, we're wired for wine. And the reason that we're wired for wine is because 10,000 years of tribal evolution, you know, we lived in villages. We didn't have agriculture. Wine was our religion. Wine was our medicine. That's how we purified our water. That's how we had fun. Like it was an intrinsic part of all of our lives for thousands of years. And so neurologically, we're sort of wired for it. And when you talk to wine people, many of them have a similar story to mine where there was some experience that just turned the switch on. Think. And that's what happened to me. The switch went on, and I was like, holy shit, I'm doing this. And that's how it
Wow. And
happened.
how many years ago was that then, Michael?
I think I was about 22, maybe, and I'm 50 now. So about 30 years ago.
Wow.
And the cool thing about wine is it's there's no end. There's no end to wine. Like you could learn your entire life and you would still not even begin to scratch the surface of what there is to know.
So, if someone is trying to get into wine, and maybe learn more about it, what are some of the basic things, Michael, that you would, want them to be able to pay attention to, shall we say, so that they can get more familiar? What are the big sort of things for someone who's a newbie to wine?
So I think the thing about wine for most people, it's intimidating. Much more so in America perhaps than in Europe. But it's intimidating. There's so much to know, and the waiter has this big book that he's handed to you, and you've got to sort through all this shit that you don't know what it means, and you're like, I and pick something that's not embarrassing to the people that are at your table, and the waiter's not going to look down his nose and go, oh, you're do you sure you want that? So you end up channeling in on a couple of things that you know are safe bets, and then you just keep making those safe bets. And I think that that's a terrible, terrible way to approach this visceral experience. I mean, that's sort of akin to saying, oh, I figured out I like fried chicken, and no one's going to make fun of me for ordering fried chicken, so I just have fried chicken for every single goddamn meal. Like, it's absurd. And yet we're okay on a menu going, that dish sounds really interesting. I have no idea what that is. I want to order it. But with wine, we're not. And so one of the things that I think is the easiest thing for people to do that are trying to get into wine is if you go to a wine store or if you're in a restaurant, order something that you have no idea what it is. And don't worry about whether it's red or white or sweet or fortified or sparkling, whatever. I don't know what this is. I'm going to order this and I'm going to try it. And I'm going to see what I think about it. And it's okay if it sucked. It's okay to hate it. It's okay to say, like, ah, I don't prefer this. I'm going to try something else next time. And I'm going to see if I prefer that. And over time, what you'll do is you'll A, develop your palate for like what you like. And B, you'll what I found is when I've done this and I found something I do like, I go home and I look it up, like, what the hell was that? Like, I take a picture of it with my phone. I'm like, what the hell is this? Like, this is really good. And then you go back and you do a little research, like, ah, oh, wow, this is from Italy. Who knew? Yeah, great. So that's the one biggest piece of advice I could give to anybody is just buy stuff you don't know what it is. Pick your price point and find something you don't recognize the name at all. You've never heard of it, and just give it a go and see what happens. And it's
Yeah,
okay
I
if it
think
sucks.
that's good advice actually, because I think sometimes there's a lot of snobbery around wine. It's a bit like certain sports. Skiing is another sport where people are all quite intimidated by skiing, and if you're an expert pro skier, there's a lot of kind of nervousness around trying and getting out on the slopes. And I think wine's a bit like that. And if you're in certain company, it's maybe people like to show off, right? As well, around, oh, choosing the most expensive bottle of wine, or
Oh,
only
look what
choose
I
this.
got. Oh, look at this. Yeah,
Yeah,
exactly. Come on.
and I think that can be really intimidating for people, especially if you're in company. So how do you discern someone that's genuinely knowledgeable about wine and someone that maybe is
Who's full of
showboating?
shit? Yeah, well, that's a great question. What I would say is as I've gone through, studying for higher level industry qualifications, and I'm trying to become the 61st American to ever be certified as a master of wine, and I've written a bunch of books about wine, and I've got other industry certifications, and I'm a sommelier, and like you go through this process, and at some point your ego takes over, and you become that person for a little bit, and so I've been that person, and then at some point you realize, oh shit. This is way more than anyone could ever know, and this is a journey, not a destination. So I'm going to go on that trip. But having been on it, I can recognize it when I see it. I can tell when I meet someone and I talk to them, where in that arc they're at pretty quickly, just by listening to the way that they talk about wine and the way that they describe it and the way that they think about wine. And there's, you know, there's nothing better than, and all my friends know this, like, I don't give a shit about having the most expensive bottle of wine. Matter of fact, if you show up at my house and you have a really expensive bottle of wine to give me because you're trying to prove something, which I'll tell you a story. This happened to me, I don't know, a month ago. Somebody who I'd never met before had come to my house and they had brought me a bottle of very expensive Italian super Tuscan wine. And I know that she was sitting there thinking like, oh, he's going to be so impressed and so stoked about this. But I wasn't at all. I'm like, okay, what am I going to do with this? This needs to go sit down for 10 years before it's drinkable. And also, I don't like this wine. It's too over-oaked. It's too extracted. But it was expensive. And so thank you, I guess. What I appreciate far more is when people show up at my house and they play a game that's called Bring Mike a Bottle That He's Never Had Before and Doesn't Know What It Is. So they search out like weird stuff to bring me. And then they show up and they're like, have you had this? I'm like, holy shit, I've never had that. I don't know what that is. Let's try it. And we try it and together. And sometimes it's great and sometimes it's horrible. But you have an experience with people that you give a shit about and it's fun.
I love that. I love that. You know, I think back to when I was growing up as a kid in the UK, and back then, wine was not the thing. All you could get, the brands of wine that were sort of most available and common were Blue Nun, Liefra Milch, Black Tower, Matthias Rosé, and that was pretty much it, you know. And I mean, I grew up in a very working class families, but so we weren't really wine drinkers, but I remember there just wasn't the choice. And obviously, you know, the industry has changed a lot. So how has the winemaking industry changed from sort of, let's say, 20 years ago, 30 years ago, when you first got into it, to today? What are some of the big shifts in whether it's production or consumer taste or variety or distribution? What are the big shifts, you think?
So I think the biggest thing that's happened probably over the last, let's call it 30 years, is global supply chain. And to your point, like back then, you're in the UK and you had Blue Nun, Liefra Milch, you know, Black Tower. That's what the supply chain worked to get to the UK. And so, but at the same time, all over the world, people are planting grapes and making wine. And they're figuring out how to make wine that is an expression of that particular location, like champagne. The whole reason that champagne has bubbles is because it's too goddamn cold there to make regular wine. So they figured out another way of doing it. In Madeira, the whole reason it's fortified is because it's an island and they had to ship it by boat and all the wine would spoil. And so they fortified it with brandy to get it there. Like, there is a point to all these different styles of wine all around the world, but we didn't have global supply chains to bring those options to people. And so that's kind of the first thing that's happening on the supply chain side. On the demand side, it's pretty interesting. Boomers are dying, and the boomers that are living are drinking less wine because they're dying, right? So they're not spending the money that they used to. And that segment of your market demographics are the people with disposable income who are buying the expensive stuff. They're being replaced with Gen Z, and Gen Z is a tricky bunch. Gen Z, first off, they're not category one at all. Like, you probably remember, I don't know if your parents drank, but if they did, your dad probably had a drink. He was a Guinness man, or he was a whiskey man, or he was a Scotch man, whatever he was, that's what he was. He wasn't coming home going, we're having gin and tonics tonight. And then the next night we're having rosé. You know, that category loyalty is not present with the Gen Z folks. And so it's harder to figure out what we want to sell to them. And then they're also digital natives, and they're the dopamine generation, right? So they're all looking at their damn phones and needing, you know, that constant kind of dopamine hit. And so now I need to figure out what to sell to them and then how to sell it to them, which is very different than the boomer who is really stoked to get this month's allocation of Silver Oak, right? And so that's we've got the supply side changing and we've got the demand side changing, and that's creating a lot of chaos in the industry. At the same time, you have this massive expansion of choices. Like growing up in the UK, you had four. How many do you have today? Thousands,
Thousands,
right?
yeah.
Right. And so, you know, how do you tell a brand story that stands out in this kind of sea of options that is compelling? And also, you know, we've done a really good job with the younger generation of making sure that every goddamn product has a social value story that aligns with their whatever those values happen to be. You know, I like there's a transgender one, you know, it has a rainbow can. And for the people that are really supportive of trans, that they're going to drink that wine because of the rainbow can, not because it's necessarily the best wine or they love the taste or whatever, but because they're aligning their social values with what that represents. And there's something to be said to that, I think, from a marketing and sales perspective. But at the end of the day, I'm a wine guy. Like, make the best damn wine you can. And it should be about the wine, not about the story. But that's where we are.
Yeah, interesting. But yeah, my
I sound like
partner
a
and I.
grumpy old man. Like, ah, you
No.
kids, stay off of my lawn with your trendy wine trends and I'm that
Well,
guy.
no, not at all, not at all. And we're going to talk about the business and kind of what you're trying to do in terms of shaking things up with the Bhutan wine company that you've got, right? We'll talk about that in a little while. But one of the things that I kind of really have appreciated over the years, and I'm not a wine connoisseur at all, I kind of know roughly what I sort of like, you know, but I'm not an expert at all. But we went traveling around South America for 3 months, backpacking a few years ago, and we're in Argentina, so you know, obviously Malbec, etc., had some incredible wines, and we were over in Mendoza. And we went round lots of different wineries, and some were tiny little places, some were a little bit more polished, you know, you'd sit and have a nice dinner, etc. But there was a story behind every winery, and very often it was linked to the family or, you know. So I really started to appreciate that aspect of wine. Yes, the wine was the end product. But actually, the history of the winery, the family tradition, etc., I've never really fully appreciated before. And I don't know if that's something which you see is sort of as well known to people as maybe it could be in terms of them falling in love with a brand or with a certain winery, because it's got personality, right?
So I have a really good friend who owns a winery in Alsace, France. And he is about, let's see, he's about 30 years old. So a little bit younger than me. A lot younger than me. But he's the 14th generation winemaker, and they've been working the same hill for 14 generations. And now it's his turn to work the hill. And like that to me is an amazing story. And like I've sat on the hill. I've had lunch on the hill. I've eaten grapes off wine on the hill, and I've had his wine in his winery. That's a really cool story. I have another friend who started making wine in Australia, and he has basically no money, but he cares about wine, and so he figured out a way that he could get some leases on grapes, and he leased space in the basement of someone's house, and that's where he's making wine. And you go there, and he's got like plastic flip chairs, you know, that you can sit on in this basement and drink this wine, or he's trying to make these amazing different varietals that you wouldn't expect in Australia, like Nebbiolo. And he's doing an amazing job with it. And he's just like, this is what I'm trying to do. Another really amazing story, completely different, right? From the 14 generation guy working the same hill. You know, he's in a basement in Australia leasing space and trying to come up with wine. And that's really cool too. And I think the idea that there is a story behind every bottle of wine, if you're interested enough to go seek it out, makes it that much cooler. And like the basement guy. Like, I'm in America, I don't see his wines that often, but if I'm in a restaurant or whatever and I see it on the list, I'm like, I'm getting Luke Lambert. Holy shit, let's go. I can't believe they have that here. And when I have that wine, I remember sitting in that basement on the plastic flip chairs, drinking wine and eating, you know, prosciutto that we were just carving off of the hank of pig that was sitting there. And it's just it's about experiences, I think.
Yeah, I love that. I love that. Now let's talk about Bhutan. So
That's
Bhutan,
the place that you've never been to as a travel professional.
I
Just so
know, thank you for
we're
reminding me, but I the reason I
clear.
haven't been is because I heard that there's going to be this incredible event this year in 2024 where wine is going to be produced there for the first time. So I've been waiting, Michael, for this event to
Just biding
actually,
your time. Perfect.
honestly, so it's not your normal on the beaten track place, let's face it. It's pretty remote. It's sandwiched between China and India in the Himalayas, right? It's a small kingdom. How did you first, well, fall in love with Bhutan? And then secondly, find out that this is such a great opportunity that you actually set up your own wine company, winery there. Tell us the story.
Yeah, so the story is interesting. I had never heard of Bhutan until I met my significant other, who read a book about a woman who moved to Bhutan in the 80s and fell in love with the place and stayed. And so the whole time we've been together, she's been going, Bhutan, 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 Bhutan. I'm like, I don't give a shit, like, whatever. But I got the opportunity. I was running marathons around the world. And I was on a bunch of email lists, and I got an email that said first Bhutan marathon. And so I clicked on it, and they said we're allowing, Westerners to come in to run the first Bhutan marathon. If you'd like to be considered, we're taking 10 people, sign up here. So I signed up immediately, like, let's go. And they accepted us. And so I went to my girlfriend and I was like, hey baby, we're going to Bhutan. Congratulations, we finally get to go. And she goes, oh my God, we're going to the Himalayas. And I go, no, we're not. Bhutan's in Indonesia. And she goes, no, it isn't. And I go, yeah, it is. And she goes, look it up. And I pulled my phone out and I looked it up. I was like, holy shit, I just signed us up to run a marathon in the Himalayas. So that's how we got there initially. I didn't know anything about Bhutan at all. When we got there, it became readily apparent to me, like, we as Westerners, we think about the Himalayas and you think about like these glaciers and, these snow-capped peaks and stuff, and that's true, but the ground is extremely fertile, the water is microplastic free, the sunlight is very clean and pristine and not fucked up with ozone and stuff. So they actually grow some of the world's best crops in the Himalayas. And as climate change is impacting global wine regions, there's a narrative that says the Himalayas may be the next wine region for everybody. And there's some big name companies that are trying to look into this on the Chinese side of the Himalayas. So I'm in the Himalayas, and everything I'm eating is the best thing I've ever eaten. And there's these beautiful terrace slopes. I just assume there's wineries. So everywhere I go, I'm asking people, where are the wineries? Where are the wineries? Where are the wineries? And like, what are you talking about? I end up at a dinner with some government officials and I say to them, hey, where's the wineries? I want to visit them before I leave. And they go, well, we don't have wineries. And I go, how is that possible? And I kind of get a little bit affronted and I like start kind of riffing, like, you guys are fucking up. Like, this place is perfect. How are you not doing this? Every place in the world that can grow great wine does and has for thousands of years. How did this come to be? Like, we never had grapes, no one ever brought them here. We're surrounded by the Himalayas, like, we're in this magical little valley, there's no wine. And I go, well, you need to fix this right now. And I went home and I wrote a white paper saying this is why I believe this, and I sent it to him. And I was like, you should do this and let me know when it's done. I want to come try the wine and maybe just know I had a little bit of a hand in making this happen. And so that kind of started the conversation. And eventually the country said, we really want to try this. We're not sure if it's going to work, but we really want to try it. And I was like, you should try this immediately. They said, we'd love to do it with you. And I was like, wait, you're going to give me this blank canvas of a whole country to create a wine industry and I get to do it? I'm this punk rock skateboard kid from Southern California. Like, you're giving me this? Are you kidding? I'm 100% in on this. Like, this hasn't happened since New Zealand did it in the 1800s. In 200 years, this hasn't happened. And you're going to let me do it? Let's go.
Wow.
So that's
So
how it started.
So where are you on the journey of that then, from that very initial conversation? And may I say, the reason why, in my opinion, why they wanted you to do it is because of your passion, your energy, your enthusiasm, because you everything it just oozes out of you, Michael. So I think you probably subconsciously did a great sales job on them, right? Just because you're so passionate and love what you do.
So that's the God's honest truth. I was like just hammering these guys, going, "You have to do this. You have to do this. You have to do this." And then they're like, "Oh wow, okay, let's do this." So we've been at this since about 2017. I have about 200 acres of vineyards. Currently, we're trying to expand that to about 2,000 acres of vineyards. We have vineyards at altitudes ranging from about 500 feet in elevation all the way up to like over 9,000 feet in elevation. We're trying different methods. We're trying different grapes. We're trying different stuff, seeing what works. You know, like Burgundy had the benefit of monks cataloging every fucking vine in a vineyard for 200 years. Like they took, like, this is what we did this year, and then the next year we grew it 6 inches taller, and then we grew it 6 inches, and they figured out how to do it. So we're trying to figure that out, and with no history, right? So it's all trial and error. We made our first barrel of wine last year. I have not tasted the wine yet; it's aging. But my initial taste trials of the grapes leads me to believe that we're onto something. I think it's going to take another 10 to 15 years to dial it in. We will do our first commercial harvest this year. So we'll actually make some wine that we'll be selling, you know, to the general public. I mean, I think particularly as you look at how climate change is impacting global regions like Bordeaux and Champagne and Napa and so on and so forth. I mean, I think the Himalayas, you know, if we fast forward 50 years, that might be where people are looking to get the best wines in the world. And I wasn't kidding when I said, like, other people think this too. Like Louis Vuitton Moët Hennessy has a project in the Himalayas in China, on the Chinese side. I just happen to be the only person doing it in the Kingdom of Bhutan, at least at this point. So it's been this amazing journey. Like I can't even, I don't have good words to say what this has been like for me.
And how has this brought out the entrepreneur in you then, Michael? Because, you know, this is a startup, right? It's a startup. You're a management consultant, 30 years in, you know, advising all other organizations, I'm sure, on, you know, how they leverage opportunities. But this is entrepreneurial, right? So how's that brought out the entrepreneur in you, do you think? What have you learned about yourself through the process?
Well, you know, I've always been an entrepreneur. Like I started my first company when I was about 19. I never even went to college initially. My goal was to go run a business, and I started a couple different ones that didn't go anywhere, and then I started one that started to go somewhere and then failed spectacularly. And that was when I was like, I should probably have some education because this whole business thing is harder than it looks like. And so off I went to get an MBA, and I didn't have an undergraduate degree, so I had to get that along the way. And then I never had any intention of joining a management consulting firm. My goal was always, you know, get the MBA and go back out and start a company. And they convinced me to join them. And I've had the opportunity to start, I think about seven or eight different businesses for the firm over the, you know, almost 30 years that I've been there. And so, you know, this wasn't like, oh, all of a sudden you had to be an entrepreneur. It was like, oh, you've always been one. But one of the things that I'll tell you a story. Here's the way I think about entrepreneurism. I was stupid enough to go run a marathon down near the South Pole. And we flew a jet into the middle of Antarctica, crash landed on a glacier, jumped out, and we ran a marathon. And I had all the wrong gear. And so my goggles froze over pretty early on. And there's no track, there's no safety nets, there's no tents, there's no people out there handing you cookies. It's like you and a glacier go run a marathon. And what they had done is they'd driven a snowmobile. So there was a little track that carved out in the snow, and you had to run on it. But my goggles were frozen over and I couldn't see. And they told us, don't take your goggles off because you'll go snowblind very quickly and it will be very bad for you. So I'm running by braille. Basically, what I would do is I would sort of try to look out the bottom of my goggles and look at the ground and sort of stay in the track until I ran into the side, and then I would fall down. And then I would pick myself up and I would run a little bit more until I ran into the snow on the other side, and then I would fall down. And I did this for miles, so much so that the people behind me thought I was having some sort of a medical event. And they reported me to the medical people because they're like, this guy's just crashing and crashing and crashing. That's what I feel like being an entrepreneur is like, you are going to fall. It's going to hurt. It's going to suck. And it is going to be just inordinately challenging. And all you have to do is pick yourself up and keep going and keep making forward progress. And guess what? You're probably going to fall again. And so that's what the Bhutan Wines Company been like. Let me tell you stories about the wasp problem we had this year, or the leopard problem that we had this year, or the monkey problem, or all of these problems that regular wine regions don't have. I could have gone to Napa and done a nice, safe little Cabernet vineyard and planted some Cabernet and neat little rows and, made another Napa cab. But no, instead, I'm fighting murder wasps in Bhutan. And when I tell you they're murder wasps, they call them seven sting wasps because if they sting a cattle seven times, the cow dies. These things are gnarly and they love grapes. So how do we deal with that? And it's a Buddhist country, so you can't kill anything. It's not like you can be out there just spraying waspicide, over. No, you gotta gently relocate the murder wasps who are trying to eat your grapes. Yeah,
Just
it's
a
a
few
run.
little hurdles to overcome, but it will mean when you taste that wine for the first time, it'll be all the more pleasurable knowing that you've been on this crazy ride, right?
Correct. Yep. It makes it that much more interesting. And also, we just don't know what we're gonna get. It might suck. I will say, so I had this minute. So last year, we've been working on this. This is all the Mike Juergens vision. I believe that this thing could produce something amazing, but we don't know, right? And so I was there last year, and we were harvesting some grapes, and I took my first bite of a Bhutanese grape, and it was Malbec. And I remember sitting there and I picked the grape and I'm looking at it and I'm sitting there going like, what if it sucks? What if it sucks? What if it sucks? And the rational part of me is like, yeah, dude, you pick yourself up, you keep running. Maybe this is not a Malbec site. Maybe this is a Chardonnay site. Maybe the altitude's wrong. Maybe we trellised it wrong, whatever. But, my head is trying to rationally tell me this, but my heart's going, what if it sucks? What if it sucks? What if it sucks? And I eat the thing and it's just bursting with flavor, just the biggest expression of Malbec flavor in my mouth ever. And I was like, holy shit, I was right. I fucking knew it. I fucking knew it. I had to literally had to go take a minute, sit up. I'm getting choked up about it now. I had to go sit in the corner of the vineyard by myself and just cry for a couple of minutes because we did it. And we were right. And
Amazing.
yeah, that level of that emotional experience, the power and depth of that is like something that ordinary people don't get to experience unless they do something extraordinary. And that's what we're trying to do.
Yeah, well, I honestly, I just know it's going to be incredible. You've poured your heart and soul into this, and it's really well, it's thank you for sharing because it's coming from the heart, right? And I think that's where we make incredible things happen when we care about stuff, really.
Yeah, I mean, if you assume that winemaking is an art, which we could debate whether or not it is or it's not, but let's assume that it is. Yeah, you're basically pouring everything you've got into this thing that people then get to experience once and then it's gone, right? It's ephemeral. It's not even like here's a picture that you can hang on your wall and look at. No, you get to drink it that one time and then that's it. It's a powerful and profound set of circumstances that I'm just blessedly fortunate to have gotten the opportunity or the stupidity to try to do this thing in the Himalayas.
Well, I have a different view. I'm a big believer that, you put stuff out to the world and you attract things to you, whether if you call it law of attraction or whatever. But There was a reason why this opportunity has come your way, and I don't believe it's by chance or luck. I think it's because of all of the years and years and years, all the little things that you've done, building your knowledge, helping other people understand it, putting yourself up for that, that marathon. If you'd not done that, if your girlfriend hadn't gone on about Bhutan, or
Read the book.
exactly.
All
So,
these little tiny decisions that brought us to this point. Sometimes I do think that the reason that I was put on this planet was to create the wine industry in Bhutan, because it's such an absurd long chain of circumstances that got me there in the first place. And then I had the balls to say, you guys should do something about this. And then I had the wherewithal to do, like, it's just, it's. It doesn't make any sense, but here we are, and we're about to have the first commercial vintage. And I my vision is that 50 years from now, people are going to be able to go to Bhutan like they go to Napa or Bordeaux or Burgundy today, and rolling fields of vineyards, and they can sit there with the people who pick the wine, pick the grapes, and make the wine, and have a have an experience. And I'll be long dead, but there'll be a little plaque somewhere with my name on it, said, Mike did this.
I think we'll have a big statue. We don't want a little plaque. We need something a little bit more symbolic, Mike, But no, I mean, this is legacy stuff, isn't it? This is around what mark do you want to leave on the world. And anyone listening to this podcast, whether you're into wine, whether you're into something totally different, but for me, I think the big lesson is have a big dream, have a vision, and take all those little baby steps to lead you towards whatever it is you want to kind of get to achieve. Ignore the naysayers along the way, because there's probably loads of people that'll tell you what ridiculous, it could never happen, all of that kind of stuff, and I think it's inspiring for anyone that's got a dream. Don't not take action, because you've only got one life, right? And time's short, so make it count. And that's what you're doing. You're making it count. And I love that.
Well, I think the universe presents us opportunities all day, every day. And most of us are too busy driving around with whatever stupid goal or errand that we've got going on to even become aware that the universe is presenting you with an opportunity. And then even if you are aware, then like doing something with it. Like I never set out to create the Bhutan wine industry. Like I wasn't sitting around going, oh, here's my vision board. Let's go to the Himalayas and start a wine. Like it wasn't that. It was this series of events that led me there. And then I realized the universe is presenting this to me, do something about it. And I did. And I think part of being an entrepreneur is just purely that. It's, how many people do you know? Like you do these podcasts with entrepreneurs all the time. How many people do you know that were like, sit down and explain to you this great idea that they have for a business that they're gonna do someday? And you're like, okay, well, like what? What's stopping you? Like, go
Get
do it.
going. Start now. Start small, but start. Do something. Don't just talk
Do
about
something.
it. Don't just talk about it. Talk's cheap, right? No, I agree. And I think people are fearful. Most people are fearful of judgment, failure, whatever, loss, losing money, and of course. But I think it's always learn. You either win or learn, right? I think.
You either win or learn. And I keep coming back to like when things are tough, I keep coming back and thinking about that marathon where, if you stop, you're gonna die. So here's your options. Like you can just keep failing over and over and over again, or you can just stop and fail completely. What's better? Let's go fail. And
Absolutely.
that's the way we've been treating the Bhutan Wine Project. Look, I have all these different vineyards at different altitudes, different soil types, different trellising methods. Not all of them are going to work. I expect half of them are going to fail. I have 17 different grape varietals growing there. I don't expect that 17 different grapes are going to grow there. I don't need 17 grapes. I need to find the two or the one that grow there. And if it ends up being Chardonnay or Cabernet, well, that's what we're going to do. What is the best expression of this? And the ability to fail enthusiastically and repeatedly, I think, is the harbinger of really what makes an entrepreneur successful. Just that ability to just keep failing. Thomas Edison, right? Said it best, right? I figured out 10,000 ways to not make a light bulb before he figured out a way to make a light bulb. Yeah, I'm figuring out 10,000 ways to not make Bhutanese wine right now. Hopefully hopefully it's not 10,000. Like, hopefully it's 17, but you know.
Well, it's going to be a big year for you, that's for sure. And honestly, it's been so great hearing the journey and how you've ended up with where you are and what's next to come. I think the best is yet to come for you, Michael, that's for sure. And you'll have had loads of advice over the years from people. Some of it good, some of it maybe less good, depending. Can you think of a standout piece of advice?
I can. And so this is a piece of advice. And I was thinking about this when you asked the question ahead of time. I actually gave myself this advice. And I'll give you a little bit of background. I was married for 11 years, and then I went through a 13-year divorce. So my divorce lasted longer than my marriage, and it was so much just disastrous infighting, and it was just terrible. And at the time, I was on this corporate trajectory, and I was going to be the CEO, and I was going to be in charge of everything, and blah, blah. And I was going to have the best car and all this stuff. And through that process, like, everything got stripped away from me. And it was like, what do you really want to do? Like, what is, you get one trip through, like, what do you want to do? And I spent a lot of time, probably a couple of years, trying to wrap my head around like what that was for me. And eventually I came to this phrase, which my friends will know, they've heard me say this lots of times. I just want to do epic shit with cool people. That's it. And that's the benchmark that I measure everything that I do. I don't have a lot of time. I have a lot of demands for my time. If it's not epic shit and it's not cool people, I'm not doing it, period. And I get to decide what that is for me, right? You know, like what I think is epic might not be what somebody else thinks is epic. For me, epic might be having this amazing bottle of wine at 10 o'clock in the morning with some olive oil and bread in a cafe in Rome, you know? Or it might be running a marathon in Antarctica. It's up to me to decide what that is for me. But I put that guiding kind of theory into my life about 15 years ago, and it's changed everything.
I
Everything.
love that. I love that.
I'm happier. I'm more successful. You know, I wake up every morning more motivated than trying to get the newest version of the next Cadillac Escalade. You know, who gives a shit? Guess what? In 12 months from now, there's going to be another one, and you're going to have to get another one because now yours is the old one. It's stupid.
I
So
love that. Epic
that's
shit
what.
with cool people. So I'm taking that then as a great compliment that you've given me a valuable chunk of your time. So you must think that Brave Bold Brilliant is epic. Epic shit, and I must be a cool person. I'm taking
Epic
it.
shit with cool, epic shit with cool people, Jeanette. Like, you're in Bali right now, you know, doing epic shit with cool people, and we get to connect over the internet and spend some time together. It's amazing.
Yeah, no, it's fantastic. And I'm really excited for you, actually. Well, I've got a last couple of questions for you, Michael. But before I do that, where can people connect with you best? How can they track you down?
I mean, they could go to bhutanwine.com, socalrum.com. For those of you who are interested in learning a little bit about wine, you can subscribe to my wine newsletter at drinkingandknowingthings.com. You'll get a little bit of wine information and a little bit of the Mike view on philosophically how to deal with wine. But yeah, it's a good thing. Or LinkedIn, you know, michaeljurgens.com, or what is it, Michael_Jurgens, I think, on LinkedIn. But I'm pretty easy to find.
Yeah.
There's not a lot of Bhutan wine mic guys around, so if they just plug that shit into Google, that'll come up pretty quickly.
Fantastic. I will include all that in the show notes so anyone can track you down through there as well. So fantastic. So now, Mike, before we press record, I said to you, I'm really interested to hear what your word for the year is. And you said, do you mean the last year or this year? So I said, you can do both. So, what was your, if you could describe last year in one word, what would it be and why? And if you could describe this coming year in one word, what would it be and why?
Last year would be horrific. I had a house fire. I jumped down the stairs to fight the house fire. I ruptured my Achilles tendon. I ended up spending 3 months in bed. I ended up getting hospitalized three times for different things. I got COVID a fourth and a fifth time. It was just awful. I'm just happy to slam the door shut on 2023 because it sucked. Which leads me to 2024. My word for this year is optimistic. Like, we're about to make the first vintage ever in Bhutan. I can walk again. I'm mostly healthy now. And so I'm just full of optimism to see what sort of epic shit and cool people I'm going to get to meet and do in 2024. So I didn't get to do much in 2023, just a lot of rough times. But 2024, sky's the limit.
Yeah, Mike's coming for you. 2024 double dose of epic shit and cool people this year for you. I love it. I love it. And so my last question, Michael, is what does brave, bold, brilliant mean to you?
I mean, I think brave, bold, brilliant is a different way of saying epic shit with cool people, right? It's this idea of, hey, we're gonna take risks. We're gonna try to do things that the normal people wouldn't think to try. We're gonna go after it with courage and tenacity, and hopefully the outcome is brilliant. You know, that's epic shit with cool people. It's just said in the British way. Not the Los Angeles way, right? And so what's amazing to me is being able to espouse this ideology, right? Which is you get one chance, what are you gonna do with it? You gonna sit around and watch TV, or are you gonna go for it? And my opinion is go for it.
Perfect. Well, listen, what a fantastic, time it's been chatting with you, Mike. I'm so excited for this year for you. I can't wait to see how the wine is going to come out. And yeah, the best is yet to come, but massive, massive congratulations on everything you've achieved. And yeah, good luck for this year.
Thank you very much. And you got a standing invite. Anytime you want to come over, let me know. We'll make that happen.
I'll there. Good
Awesome.
stuff. Thank you, Michael.
Thanks, Jeanette.
I really hope you've enjoyed Brave, Bold, Brilliant. Don't forget to subscribe and share with all your friends. And if you've enjoyed listening, I'd love it if you'd leave me a 5-star review.